You know, if you buy a 100-unit apartment project and it's, you know, 70% occupied and kind of run down, you can stumble your way through that, but you just cannot stumble your way through a $67 million project.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your organization's spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Neil Geary from Seton Hill Partners here to talk about his experience in dealing as a fractional CFO. More particularly, Seton Hill pride themselves on the elite status of the professionals that they work with. And we're going to learn a bit about how Neil's particular approach to managing finances has its origins in boating of all things. So Neil, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could open us up by telling us something about you that your colleagues probably don't know about you.
All right. Well, thanks, James. Nice to be with you. A lot of my stories and something people don't know in the beginning has to do with boating. So when I was younger in college, I was a boat captain in the summer at a resort hotel, and it was kind of a life-defining experience. I was able to do something I really enjoyed and met a lot of good people. And yeah, it's a lot different than sitting behind a desk as a fractional CFO, that's for sure.
Now, when I hear people who are involved in boats, like I was a sailor when I was a kid, you know, and I was not a very good sailor. I'll tell you why, because I wasn't great at preparing. Like my 90% of sailing was washing things and, you know, stripping things down and painting things. And it was a lot more preparation than it was actual sailing. And it felt like sometimes. So what do you take from your boating background, and we'll get into that a little bit more, you know, as we go on, that you apply to your day-to-day as a fractional CFO with working with your clients?
Well, it's a lot about planning ahead, diligence, safety to a certain extent, whether it be safety on a boat or safety in finances. So yeah, I was young when I did that, and part of the qualifications were to be licensed by the Coast Guard. And they really kind of scare you to death to say, look, you're responsible for people out there. When you're at sea, the captain's in charge and their lives are in your hands. So yeah, I focused on diligence and safety and being careful.
That's probably something I do still think about. I remember when I first had a boat on the water and I had a crew, like I was a small boat, but one crew and me, and that was it. We would, you know, mostly do terribly in sailing regattas. But it was the first time as a kid I had like, hey, I could really mess up here. Like there's no one I really ran to help, you know, like there was crash boats maybe at that stage, but you can do serious harm to the people you're around. And sometimes running a business feels a little bit like that. I don't know if you ever got that feeling, but like, actually it's possible to mess this thing up. And sometimes in a way that could end you up in financial trouble or even jail sometimes with the responsibilities of being ownership and so on. So it was thinking about it. Yeah. It's good because there's not many times in society or positions in society where you can mess up that badly, but running a business is maybe one of them.
Absolutely.
So tell me, what's your dream boat then? Do you already have your dream boat, or is there a boat you'd still like to get on your bucket list?
Well, I have a boat. It's a 25 foot center console power boat. I'm kind of ashamed to say what my dream boat is because I grew up, you know, in the 90s a bit with the Miami Vice scene. So honestly, my dream boat is probably a 38-foot cigarette boat. So I'd be speeding around the coastline with whomever, I guess.
Very good. All right. We won't ask. With your family, of course. But so these are muscle boats. I didn't know what a cigarette boat was. So as I see, it's like the muscle car of boating. That's my takeaway from it.
Right? Absolutely. They're very fast, very powerful, loud, kind of obnoxious, but a lot of fun.
Very good. All right. Okay. So it's not all preparation. It is preparation, but it's not all seriousness. You like to have fun too on the water. So that's good. Yeah. Okay, cool. So I like to joke that, you know, not everyone gets to be on the Gross Profit Podcast. You must be pretty good to get this far. So maybe you could just give us a little bit of the arc of your experience. How did you get into finance? You mentioned that boating had some part of it there. And how's it going so far? How have you ended up calling yourself a fractional CFO?
Yeah, so the quick story is definitely things did start with boating in a way, but I was in college at the time studying finance, and my first job was working for a family office, you know, private investment company. And I spent about 5 years with them, really learning the ins and outs of financial analysis and things of that nature. But I always kept thinking about my experience at the resort hotel, and I love hospitality. And so 5 years into my career, I had the opportunity to go back to that same resort to become a controller for the property. And that was fantastic. It was an opportunity I probably wasn't quite ready for, but sometimes those are the best ones. And so I did that for a couple of years and said, wow, hospitality is awesome and fun, but really hard and time consuming. And at that point, I went back to graduate school. I went to Babson College, which is known around the world for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Spent 2 years there and then dove back into hospitality, real estate development. And that's what I've been doing for the past 25 years.
So Babson is famous for their entrepreneurship course. Do you think entrepreneurship can be taught in a course?
No, there's definitely something in people who, you know, you're either entrepreneurial or you aren't. But I think that you can hone your skills if you have that entrepreneurial bug. And for me, I think I'm kind of on the fence. So I focus more on helping entrepreneurs and facilitating entrepreneurship. And the world really relies on entrepreneurs to come up with an idea or recognize some value and run with it. That involves a ton of risk, and I spend a lot of my time trying to slow people down a bit, or at least help manage the risk.
Yeah, I think, you know, I run a business, but I don't really class myself an entrepreneur. Like, I know, have friends, and they're straight up mad as a box of frogs in a lot of cases. Just, it's a personality trait maybe more than anything else, and you're on your own. But I like the idea of that training in Babson is more like a entrepreneur handling degree than it is maybe so you're able to understand where the weak spots are. And this is a wonderful combination oftentimes between a CFO and a traditional CEO, who they bring that sort of energy and haywire-ness to it, if you like. And it always somehow amazes me that people can get quite far by themselves, create fairly substantial businesses with very little structure in some cases, and you wonder, well, how did they ever get this far? And then you bring the right CFO in that with combination, and that control, you know, it can be an explosive difference in terms of the business and how, what it can do, where it go, how can it can scale.
You're quite right. It's always a challenge for me when I deal with, you know, successful kind of early on entrepreneurs. They don't want to hear too much about controlling expenses and diligence and everything, but eventually we find our way through that and they realize, yeah, there's a better way to do this.
How do you sell that to them? I mean, how do you bring them on board? Do you wait for them to stub their toe or?
Well, it's a combination of ways. Usually I try and take a slow process and have discussions with them and say, okay, well, what happens if we do this? What happens if we don't? Are you comfortable with the risk exposure here? What if things go poorly? So it's a balance. No one wants to hear a negative story all the time. So it's a, you know, we plan for good things, but we also anticipate bad things as well. So,
yeah, I think they're so forward-looking. If I think of process that we bring in, I always think of the value in the business. Like, you know, if someone else, sure, it's fine to have an entrepreneur running something, but if you really want to build enterprise value and someone else to value, that's where, you know, these extra processes, then maybe you could live without them today, but certainly the guy who might want to acquire your business is going to need them. And that's what gets people excited about it and say, okay, cool, I can see the value there, you know?
That's a great point. And when you're valuing a business and you get into the nuts and bolts, it becomes very clear to that owner that, you know, every $1,000, $10,000, $100,000 makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're multiplying that often with the, on the value. So I have to ask about the family office experience a little bit. I guess family office is a very broad church. It could be almost anything, I guess. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit, was there a focus? Was this equities or was it buying businesses or what sounds like a great start to your career?
It was fascinating and I was super fortunate to get that opportunity. So this family had acquired most of their money through commercial real estate, transforming kind of old mills and things into various levels of, you know, class A and B uses. But by the time I got involved with them, you know, they certainly were quite wealthy and had established this really investment company because the founder was convinced that he could beat the market, let's say. And so we had an investment team comprised of researchers, traders, managers, and we employed market timing strategies in mutual funds and various commodities, currencies. So I was trading futures contracts primarily in currencies, the S&P index, and gold. So we were really on the outer edges of things at the time and used margin to quite a big extent. And we did very well. I think over the time I was there, we were averaging about 19% a year with a relatively safe strategy.
Wow. So what does using margin mean?
You're basically amplifying your buying power in the transaction. So margin would be like, yeah, leveraging up your bets. Okay, but at the same time, we would hedge the bets too. So if things move quickly, we could limit our downside. So
interesting. So in the zeitgeist of sort of financial advice is you can't beat the market. Even the smartest people in the room can't do it. If the people who do it are just lucky, what's your feeling on that? Were they lucky or for a period of time, or can it be done? Maybe looking at your own investment strategy, where do you land? Do you say just buy an index and that's it? Or do you think you can see an opportunity?
No, I do both. And I wouldn't say that it's hard to say, you know, you shouldn't think that you can beat the market to any great extent, but you can beat it in certain periods of time. Or if you expose yourself to a little more risk, you can do better. But it's an imperfect science for sure. Personally, I like several independent companies, but I like index funds for safety. I like Berkshire Hathaway as a good investment. They're pretty well diversified. Yeah. And real estate, commercial real estate, I have a lot of money in that as well.
Okay, very good. So I'm interested, I don't want to go off the reservation too much here, but do you have clients today who are on that gap between, you know, entrepreneurship to investment? It feels like there's kind of a period, if you've become a successful entrepreneur, you're starting to build wealth. And then they start to think, okay, hold on, I've got enough money here. It started to become about managing that. Is that something you've experienced with? Like, are you able to bridge that gap between helping someone run a business and then help them manage their wealth as well?
Kind of from a broad perspective, I don't do a lot of work in specific investments outside of real estate right now. And okay. I tend towards more the entrepreneurial type. So real estate developers are always looking to roll their money into the next project because it takes a lot of cash up front. And then you make your money on the back end. But I'm trying to think, I do have a client at the moment who's much more established and long-term. And our focus with them is mostly about maximizing the use of cash and tracking cash flow over the course of the year so that any excess money can be put to work. And that's basically investing, right?
Okay. Treasury management, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what's been the biggest win in your career so far? What's your career defined by?
Yeah. So that's interesting. There's been a lot over the years. And so thinking about that, I say, well, what have I done lately, right? Because I don't want to live in the past. But one of the things I'm most proud of recently is a client I've had in the Midwestern United States. Great entrepreneur in real estate. He had acquired about 1,000 apartments on his own, you know, value add properties where he bought them kind of in tough shape, renovated them, upgraded the renters. And then he, by luck, and he kind of fell into some bigger opportunities and got in trouble with those. And so he realized, all right, there's potential here, but I need help. And that's how we connected originally. So in the course of, say, a year and a half, we took him from, you know, this big step towards bigger developments and getting in trouble to righting the ship, you know, back to the maritime thing and aligning things so that we were able to successfully capitalize a $67 million multifamily deal. And that's just kind of by saying, okay, we understand where we are. Where do we want to go? Let's put the pieces in place to get there. Let's be diligent about it. Let's be proactive, answer the questions people have ahead of time, and try our hardest. And that worked in about 18 months. So I'm not taking all the credit for that, but there were a lot of the right pieces in place. They just had not been put together correctly.
So And that's interesting. So we talked earlier about how sometimes these entrepreneurs can get quite far out to sea. Let's continue the analogy. They can get quite far out to sea. 1,000 units is very substantial in anyone's book, I guess.
Yeah.
And then they had this new opportunity they had. You describe it as another level. What made that different and what tripped him up? Why wasn't he able to just use the lessons he'd learned from the first 1,000 transactions he did and, you know, do it again? What was different about this?
Well, the new one was a ground up opportunity. So taking raw land, building from scratch, right, and building at a higher level. So say a class A. So it's really that's what you'd want to do as a developer in that space. But it takes a lot of time, a lot of money, a higher level of planning. You can't really wing it. You know, if you buy a 100 unit apartment project and it's, you know, 70% occupied and kind of run down, you can stumble your way through that, but you just cannot stumble your way through a $67 million project.
Okay, it was a greenfield project. So a new set of skills, new whatever, architects and builders, and you just not just putting a lick of paint on things.
Different level. Right.
All right, very interesting. Okay, great. So I'd like to, you brought me a great story here, and I love the stories because that brings it alive for people, you know, and sort of brings you full circle a little bit in your career as well. You had a successful established client who, believe it or not, decided to buy a hotel and restaurant for fun. Is it for fun? Am I characterizing that in the wrong way? But how did that go?
Yeah, so this client was very successful in multiple businesses over time, very wealthy, and had spent a lot of time as a family in a New England town, lots of character, skiing, boating, all that kinds of things. And they became kind of part of the town, very small town. And this kind of historic property had come up for sale. And so they decided to purchase it thinking, oh, this will be great. We can continue the traditions. We enjoy going there. It's a great part of the town. So let's buy it and continue things on. So that's with pretty much no experience in hotels or restaurants. And as a successful guy, you would think, okay, I've made a lot of money and I'm smart. I'll figure it out. It didn't really go that way. You know, hands-off kind of manager. He thought he hired the right people. He didn't hire the right people at first. There were no systems in place. And within that purchase was actually right before COVID, in fairness. So they managed to get through COVID. And that was kind of part of why it took so long. But coming out of COVID, it became clear there wasn't the right team in place and not the right system. So he got to a point where he was losing significant money, say like $200,000 a month. And he just straight up said to me, like, Neil, I could swallow losing $40,000 or $50,000 a month because I like this place, but I can't swallow $200,000 a month. Mm-hmm. So we jumped in and helped him right the ship. It really, again, is a matter of diligence. You know, a restaurant and high-end hotels, very small property, but very detail oriented, right? If someone's coming in and spending $1,000 a night on their guest room and $500 on dinner, they want it to be excellent. And you just think about all the details involved. So from a financial perspective, it's just as complicated in the sense you have to manage every little detail, whether it be the food cost in the restaurant or the cost of making the bed in the hotel room. So we basically said, you know, look, you haven't really looked at industry standards or the typical way of doing things, and there's no need to recreate the wheel here. So we implemented some typical things and said, look, you need to maintain your individuality here, but we want to give your team the right tools and focus everyone on looking forward, get people focused on not only hospitality, but profitability, because if you're not profitable, you can't be hospitable for the long run.
I love it. You're not profitable. You can't be hospitable. It's great. So people and process, that's what I heard there. Let's take the hard part first, the people. When you walked in the door, how did you, because I often feel like, you know, a good fraction of CFO is much closer to a diplomat than they are anything else. Like it's the news is in black and white, but it's how you deliver it is what it's all about. So how did you, when you walked in the door, how did you see straight away what needed to change? And how did you manage that process? Was it rip it all out and let's do this? Or were you like, hold on, let's eat the elephant one piece at a time?
Yeah, well, it's an evolving process. So certainly in the very beginning, you have to tread lightly. I mean, you don't want to offend anyone. And so there were a lot of problems. So it's a matter of trying to identify those problems without embarrassing anyone or just presenting them more matter of fact. You know, and so on one hand, it's like, wow, you've got a tremendous property here. It's really nice. So many good things and a lot of potential at the same time, right? Mm. They're just to look and say, there's no reason you can't be making more money here. And it's a balance. I mean, really in the beginning, I remember meeting with the general manager and it's pretty clear if I don't have him on my side, we're not going to make any progress. So everyone's got to work together as a team. And anyone who tries to, you know, manage the team by muscle is going to probably have some difficulties, certainly coming from the outside.
Okay, so I'm interested about that conversation with the GM. What's your strategy there? Like, do you sort of say, hey, you know, these Yelp reviews don't look great. What do you think about that? Or was it your gross margin is atypical? Here's a benchmark. What do you think about that? Or how do you influence them towards the right decision? Or did you have to go one step further and bring in a new GM? Or, you know, was that thought in your mind?
That thought's always in my mind. But at first it was to, you know, kind of investigate and learn from him his view of the problems, right? And it turned out that a lot of the problems originated with the owner. So I said, you know, for such a high-end property, I can see some details here that aren't particularly well managed or more like maintenance issues.
Right.
And that was like a cost-cutting measure after COVID. And I said, well, that's going to work against you. You can't continue to charge high rates and be saving money at the same time. You got to be all in on that front. And then really importantly, it became clear as I talked about profitability and budgeting, he said, I know it's strange, but we don't have a lot of visibility into that. So the owner had been really managing the finances close to the vest, and you got a bunch of good people kind of roaming around without any direction in terms of finances. So that's how it ties back to boating again with the compass, right? If it's unclear, well, you got to trust your compass and what's the direction you're heading in. That's how finances come into play. So it's okay for people to know if you're making or losing money. And if they don't, they're probably not making good decisions.
So for the first time, then it sounds like the management team got a view on how the business was doing or had a view into the money. So did you roll out a budget? How did you, first of all, I guess you, did you do the budget with the owner to see what he, I guess not losing 200K a month was job number one, right? So that was obvious. Right.
It was actually kind of low hanging fruit because the team was pretty strong and very enthusiastic. So yeah, it was a collaborative process to say, let's do a budget looking forward. And, you know, not the owner doing the budget saying to the restaurant manager, here's what you need to do. It's talking with the restaurant manager and saying, we've got a great asset here. What do you think we can do? And let's step through that process. And it starts with something as simple as how many days a week are you open? How many hours a day do you serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What market are you going after? Right. And then you make all your decisions and the numbers follow. And then you say, okay, here's what we plan. Do we think it can work? Yes or no? And then bring it back to the owner and say, here's our budget. Here's how we got there. Take a look and we'll answer your questions. And that generally works pretty well.
Okay. I like that idea. Did you, and then breakfast, lunch, and dinner doesn't work. You introduced high tea, I guess, and then something else in mid-morning snacks, or you keep going until you get the numbers you need.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm interested, you know, at Procurement Express, I'm fascinated often about, you know, you have that plan and that budget, but then operationalizing it is the key part, like bringing the, you know, giving people oversight if they're back of house and let's say they're, I don't want to use the wrong terminology here, but say if they're responsible for housekeeping, just being able to manage that cost or understand what part their cost has in the overall picture. So do you, what level do you bring the financial transparency to? Is it the GM level or do you go down to the sort of department heads within that? Or do you go a further step to the guy who's painting at the front of the hotel or what's your strategy?
Well, it's every level for sure, but I like to focus on department heads and encourage them to talk with their staff so they understand what's going on. But an example from, you know, 25 plus years ago, prior to a lot of technology, at this big resort, I remember dealing with the head of housekeeping continually and big budget, right? And what we experienced there was people trying to do a good job, but you know, say buying more things, buying more than they need ahead of time or not understanding what they need. So back then we had a paper-based purchase order system that was, you know, at this point really old-fashioned, but it worked really well. And that's always been stuck in my mind through time. So even though someone had a budget and they're responsible for that budget, when they were going to make a purchase, they'd fill out the purchase order, go through the approval process. And once they had that copy back in their box, then they could proceed. And it worked really well. So just another level of diligence, and not only in planning and budgeting, but in purchasing as well.
So there's often pushback. No one, as I say, no one buys a purchase order system for fun. And there's, you know, what do you say when people say, well, you know what, Neil, this is like $150 a week. Wow, why are you making me fill out a purchase order for that? Or are you more pragmatic and you're like, well, actually anything under a certain amount, go at it. You can approve it yourself and then introduce limits, or how do you approach that?
Well, it depends on the size of the business for sure. Thinking back on these hotel businesses, you know, they've all been in the millions of dollars of revenue. So I think that's a point at which it becomes easy to justify. But it's more a matter of a discussion about, have you seen any lack of clarity, irresponsibility in purchasing in the past? Have you seen things stocked up that you don't necessarily need? Do we know that there's a cost component to that? Are you concerned about theft or damage of materials? So tight inventory controls on whatever you're purchasing, even if it's not an inventory item, that's generally not too hard to convince people of. But when you're talking specifically about a dollar amount, yeah, we could do a quick return on investment and some assumptions and say, yeah, maybe this is, you know, a couple $1,000s a year you didn't want to spend, but make a case to say it's going to pay off in the long run, and it's going to have implications across your management structure, getting people to focus on the best way to run a business.
Yeah, my sense is it sets a statement as well. Like, it sets a culture of, yeah, actually we are trying to make an ROI here. We're trying, that's how we survive. This is how the golden goose lays its eggs, is by everyone being part of the spending decisions. And that culture is actually maybe more valuable than the money you might even save. Like, sure, you can definitely, there's studies out there showing you'll save, you know, 10-15% on spend if you put it through an approval process. That's true. And 10-15% isn't nothing. But at the same time, the power, you know, and bringing the people into the financial conversation so they feel empowered creates a culture which is much more focused on that profitability. So how did it work? I guess we wouldn't have picked this story if it didn't have a happy ending, right? You haven't told us about that. We didn't want to talk about any disasters. So where is that business now? Maybe we can look it up. And I don't know if I can stretch to $500 for dinner, to be honest, but maybe I can go for high tea there, you know?
So the business has not reached its full potential yet, but it's well on its way there. So year to year, it's had great improvements. And I think in another year or two, it'll be firmly in profitable territory. So it was a bad circumstance of COVID happening, a new owner, perhaps paying a little too much for the property. You know, some things can't be fixed, right? But you can at least explain them and say, okay, what's a reasonable return on this investment now in this market? And we've definitely done that. So I think the owner is much more comfortable. So, you know, backing up, you could certainly pay more for an asset, like a trophy asset, and understand you're not going to make money on it. That's an okay decision for an owner, but that just wasn't the understanding in the beginning. So now it's more clear.
What I like about this story is, I mean, you've obviously got some fairly high-end clients, but you got your hands dirty to help your clients no matter what they needed, right? So that was what I like about this. Maybe tell us a bit more broadly, who's an ideal client for you? Maybe someone who's listened to this, who should reach out and how can they go about doing that?
Well, you know, I like to work with a whole variety of people, so I hate to narrow down an ideal, but I think where I can add the most value is certainly in the commercial real estate business, in hospitality, which is very broad, hotels, restaurants, country clubs, things of that nature. And as a result of all this, I've had a lot of experience in construction, which ties into development quite a bit. So ideal client for me is, whether it be a big or small business, someone with an entrepreneurial mindset, that's probably going to rest well with me, and a view towards growing. So it's much more exciting to manage a growing enterprise than kind of a stable one, at least for me. So
yeah. Well, amen to that. I mean, you're growing or dying. That's it, right?
So yeah.
Neil, this has been really interesting. People can reach out to you on LinkedIn. That's how I found you. And there's also Seton Hill Partners. You can Google to see Neil there and the rest of the team he works with. Seton Hill is kind of a partnership. Is that correct? It's a partnership model. You're kind of semi-independent and you work together when you need to.
Yeah, it is a true partnership. We have almost 100 partners across the United States right now. And we all are very independent, work under this partnership, and it's been very successful. So while I have my specialty, throughout the 100 partners, there are specialists in pretty much every industry. So if I come in contact with someone and I can't serve their needs, I certainly will find the right resource, whether it be within Seton Hill or not. So that's always a big focus, is let's find the right people to do the job and things will go well.
Very good. Thanks very much. And thank you for listening this far. Neil, if they've made us this far into the podcast, I feel like we have to give them something, you know? They can't send them home empty-handed. So my favorite thing to give them is a subscription to our newsletter. I know what you're thinking. That's a horrible thing to give people. Why would you want to be on a better newsletter? Well, let me tell you about our newsletter. I figured out that actually, if I rounded up recent examples of how things have gone wrong from the finance team and put it in my newsletter, people read it like wildfire. So now what we do is I find examples from the last week's news of how finance teams have made mistakes that we all can all learn from. That can be in municipalities, it can be in NGOs, it could be in private business. And the main aim is to help my subscribers stay out of the newsletter by learning from other people's mistakes. So we've had the likes of Naomi Campbell in the newsletter, who had a charity who was doing things with the money that they shouldn't have been, allegedly. And a couple of other so it's a little bit salacious. I'm not going to lie. It's a little bit salacious to sort of vicariously wonder how people get it wrong. But I think we can all learn from it. So sign up for that. You can also get notified then when podcasts like this come out, so you can learn from professionals like Neil and other fractional CFOs I have on the podcast. Thanks very much for the conversation. I really enjoyed it. You've inspired me to see the sort of lived and go and see the New England lifestyle now. It sounds so nice and sort of comfortable and high end. I don't know. Maybe someday I'll graduate doing my holidays out there.
Yeah, if you come out here, I'll take you on a fast boat ride.